morning and welcome to MTSU On the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, and the studios of WMOT-FM. The future of life sounds, at first blush, like it might be a redundancy. Is there life without a future? Is there future without a life? But it is a fall semester course for 2010. It's a 4,800-level philosophy course, brand spanking new, that will be taught on Mondays and Wednesdays from 2:20 to 3:45 in room 202 of the James Union Building by Dr. Phil Oliver, who's a professor of philosophy and our guest today on MTSU On the Record. Welcome back, Phil.
Thank you for having me back, Jenna.
The future of life examines what kinds of issues?
Well, it examines questions about the sustainability of life on Earth, so certainly ecological, environmental issues. I'm going to read Bill McKibben's latest book, which he calls Earth, and I have to prolong the pronunciation of that. He says you should say it as though you were Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Because it's spelled E-A-A-R-T-H.
Two A's, sort of like Earth 2.0 maybe, but he's looking for a different way to say that.
Yeah.
And his view, which has been his view for a long time, people who followed him ever since he wrote End of Nature way back when, his view is that we have got to rethink our whole commitment to a growth economy. And in the future, he thinks it's going to be time to hunker down because we missed our window of opportunity to really get on top of the climate crisis. So we'll be looking at that, but also we'll be looking at it from another angle, from the side of those who are described as by those who are less than sympathetic to them as techno-utopians or cybernetic totalists, computer geek types who think that technology can be our salvation. So,
or the polar opposites, the Luddites.
Or the Luddites. And some of them, and there's some question about whether some of those who are critical of the techno-utopians are or not Luddites. We're going to be reading Jaron Lanier, who's said to have been the founder or one of the founders of virtual reality technology. And he's written a new book called You Are Not a Gadget Manifesto, which he's going to try to make the case that we've gone too far in the direction of assimilating ourselves to the Sheen paradigm.
Let me back up and say, I don't want to cast aspersions on the Luddites because many of us have issues with technology and its integration. I suppose the true polar opposite of the people you're talking about would be somebody like Ted Kaczynski, who took it to an unpalatable and intolerable extreme by killing people.
Right. No one whom Jaron Lanier is targeting has gone to that extreme or has advocated violence in order to take us back to an earlier age. No, that wouldn't do it.
Right.
But some of them have very strange ideas, or the ideas that strike me and some others as strange, about how we may be on the verge of, they say, merging machines. So we're right on the edge of a post-human world. People like Bill McKibben think that's maybe not where we want to go.
I guess he's heard a few Pink Floyd albums.
That's right.
Welcome to the Machine.
That's right. Welcome to the Machine. Just another brick.
Either that or he's watched 2001 A Space Odyssey several times and actually likes Hal.
There are, there are, in this genre of dystopian looks at the future, there are a lot of really good, scary examples. And one of my favorites was by a novelist named E.M. Forster, not famous for writing science fiction, but he wrote a story called The Machine Stops, in which he imagined a future race of, they live underground. They shun any kind of immediate experience, certainly with nature. Nature is long gone, under the ground, well-wired, plugged into all the machines. And this was written in the 1930s or 40s, way ahead of Y2K. Anybody out there still remembers Y2K, worries about everything stopping in the year 2000.
Which didn't materialize.
Didn't materialize, fortunately. But that was the premise of this older story by E.M. Forster, and his point was, if we allow ourselves to become too dependent upon our technology, we may face such a time. Without resources, without luck, that'll be it for us.
One of the other items you bring up, and this pertains partially to technology, but not exclusively, is biomedical ethics.
Right.
That, I assume, would get into questions about abortion and euthanasia.
Abortion, euthanasia, and as well biotechnological issues that I see related to that. But certainly questions about how we regard life, whether we are, they call a right to life, those issues come up. And this course is sort of the evolved latest stage of a course that began years ago, biomedical ethics, is trying to take on board some of the other issues that come up in our time. Biotechnology, the question is questions of genetic engineering, which technology is about to enable, if it hasn't already, for large numbers of where one can begin to consider sort of product selecting one's progeny. Now, what kind of kid do I want?
Mm-hmm.
Do I want to select a genetic profile that will raise the like of my child, be a basketball star or a musician?
Or picking sex.
Or
picking race, for that matter.
Exactly. There are real issues of ethical issues of whether any one of us has the right to intervene in development. Think of it as redevelopment, next generation.
With regard to our relationship as human beings with technology, isn't the penultimate question, are you controlling the machine, or is the machine controlling you?
Right, and I like to think of it in terms of a very simple metaphor. Computers and other technologies are our tools. They began as our tools, and what happens when the tool takes over? I haven't fundamentally lost control of that relationship. And Jaron Lanier certainly is an example of someone who thinks that recover that metaphor and insists that our social networks and virtual environments be at our disposal and under our control to the extent that can be, and that we not sort of pay lip service, leading perhaps to being co-opted by the possibility of this merged world that some people talk about, a world in which humans no longer have an independent status.
But in an age in which some of us are text messaging night and day and don't stop and seem to never get off the computer and seem to never stop watching television, for that matter, which is an older, if you want to say old school, electronic device, can it be said that we are addicted to our machines? And if we are addicted to our machines, ethically, is it our fault, or is it the machine's fault? Same question as it is with chemicals or drugs. Right. When you become addicted to drugs, are you a patient? Are you a victim? Or are you a self-destructive person who has to take 100% responsibility for it all?
Sure. I have to preface this by saying I tweet and I blog, and I spend probably way too much time hooked into the internet myself. I think the addiction issue is a reasonable concern, and I think everybody who does that needs to just therapeutically unplug periodically and say, okay, I'm not going to check email, I'm not going to check Twitter account. I'm just going to go off. If you don't like to go camping, do something. You go sit out in the backyard and look at the stars. But that is an important question when we become so caught up in technology and in its uses, many of which we think enhance the quality of our lives day to day. But when we take it too far, who bears the responsibility? And in that case, maybe if anybody's left who doesn't share that condition, they need to think about an intervention in our case and help us get off that dependency.
Philosophically or ethically, though, is there any difference between an absent parent who is addicted to technology and the workaholic parents of days of yore prior to the advance of technology, whose children suffered by the fact that they were workaholics? You know, whether they were pounding away at an Underwood manual typewriter or cutting wood outside or whatever they were doing back in days of yore.
That's a fair point too. I think it's easy to dump everything on technology, but in the end it comes back to the decision that parents and other nurturers need to make, that they're going to be actively involved in the lives of the kids. It's too easy and out to just say technology did it, it's technology's fault. We do have to take responsibility.
When it comes to the environment and our responsibility as human beings for stewardship of the environment, where in the course of a philosophical or ethical discussion does religion enter into the picture, and at what point does secular thought enter the picture?
This is one of those cases where I think we really have to do more than just talk about bridging the differences between us. A perfect example of that kind of initiative take hold was put forward by E.O. Wilson, the biologist. A couple of years ago, he wrote a book in the form of an open letter between hardcovers addressed to a Baptist minister saying, "Pastor, you and I don't agree." E.O. Wilson is a fairly famous atheist. But he says, "You and I don't agree about many things, but surely we can agree that we share the responsibility of fate of the earth, come together on that issue." I don't know what kind of a reaction E.O. Wilson's book garnered from the pastoral community, but that's the kind of thing that I think we all need to be looking to do, to put aside some of our differences, religious and otherwise, and look for common ground. And this is quite literally what we need to find, is common ground in order to save the earth.
John Muir, the great conservationist in California, was a Presbyterian, and for him, preserving the environment was doing God's work.
Sure.
You know, the old hymn, "This is my Father's world." Yet there there are plenty of capitalists who go to church on Sunday or go to temple on Saturday, who worship and whose faith I would not take it upon myself to question, who nonetheless go back to their businesses Monday through Friday and cut corners when it comes to their business's role as a corporate citizen in preserving the environment. There's a dichotomy going on here.
Yeah, there is. And the fact is, we're all pretty good at compartmentalizing our lives and not noticing contradictions like that. But yes, it's important to see that we can't put our responsibility for the fate of the earth in a box. We need to see how it is related to everything that we do. This goes for non-church goers as well. You can't just go to the rally for the earth or whatever. Bill McKibben has helped organize a lot of these events to raise awareness about the issues surrounding the climate crisis. You can't just go to the rally. You can't just talk a good game and then go back to your old slothful habits of disregarding the impact they're having on the planet. So I wouldn't want to come down in particular on religious people. I think we all have to look very honestly at whether we're doing what we have said, what many of us have said we think we should be doing in order to have a lighter footprint, live more gracefully on the earth. I'll just stop with that.
Well, even if you're atheist or agnostic, there's plain old-fashioned pragmatism. The realization that the more destruction we wreak on the only home that we have in the universe, the more it will come back to haunt us and hurt us in the final analysis. Plain old-fashioned selfishness, if nothing else.
Plain old-fashioned self-interest, to put a slightly better spin on it.
But
you can call it selfishness. That's okay. I think some forms of selfishness are enlightened. That's right. And there is, in raising the question of pragmatism, I think there's a fundamental point, pretty basic point, but important nonetheless, that philosophically, if we mean what we say when we say that we need to take responsibility for our impact on the earth, that means that we take seriously the notion that we are free agents, that what we do matters, choices that we make, how we live as consumers and as biotic citizens, as someone called it a long time ago, all of that matters. That, again, going back to the religious question, there are those who think that to be religious is to place everything in higher, better hands than our own, and I understand the motivation for saying that, but it does appear that in this case, we've got to do the cleanup work, messes that we've made. We've got to stop pumping so many hydrocarbons out in the atmosphere and can't really wait for help to come from elsewhere to do that for us.
There's another one of the texts that goes along with your class, Clock of the Long Now, Time and Responsibility by Stuart Brand, brings up the issue of how we spend our time. We're in a world in which we feel a necessity to multitask every day of our lives just in order to get the bare minimum of things on our to-do list done.
That's right.
Never seem to have enough time to do everything that we feel we want or need to do. But then here's a situation again where ethics and personal priorities run up against the need to make a buck. And nowhere is this more prevalent in my mind than with the women who feel that they have had to make choices between the mommy track and the career track, and the women who have had to balance the two of them and get absolutely no help from a non-family friendly workplace that doesn't help them with flex time and other kinds of more innovative sorts of human resources approaches to allowing them to be their fullest professional selves and yet still fulfill the parenting role in a way that helps their children the most.
That's right, and you're touching on more than one of the themes that we're going to raise in the course here, and they're all important. It's important that we all come to see that we have a shared stake in the next generation and nurture of the next generation. It's not just a mommy issue. We all need to see to it that our workplaces are organized and our lives are organized in such a way that our children are cared for correctly, raised in a way that they themselves can inherit the mantle of responsibility and address these long-term problems. And so the future of childhood is an aspect of the question of the future of life, and the near future of childhood. And I think we do need to hold our politicians and others to the flame on this, pass the right legislation so that people in the workplace can be responsible parents as well as good workers. Long-term thinking, though, longer-term thinking, you raise the question of the clock of the long now. Stuart Brand is the person who is credited with suggesting that we really ought to have a picture from space of the whole earth. He's the guy who said, why isn't there in 1969 or 68 or thereabouts, when we were sending astronauts on a regular basis up to orbit the earth and then to go to the moon? He said, why don't we, as long as we're up there, why don't we point a camera back here and take a picture of the whole earth? And I think his visionary insight there was that image could be transformative. It would encourage us to take a wider view, to see that, oh, that planet really is a fragile ball hanging out there in space. It's really vulnerable, and it is our responsibility. I think it did have that impact, that famous photograph, and others like it did have that impact on a number of people. And it's that kind of intuition that is behind what he calls the clock of the long now. And this is not just a metaphor, although it certainly functions symbolically. He and others, a computer scientist named Danny Hillis and some others, a while back had the idea that we really ought to construct a clock that would keep time in a longer frame than we're accustomed to. How about 10,000 years? You know, we don't think in long-term views, but a 10,000-year clock, a clock that was designed to ding at 10,000 years, might wake us up, or at least might get us to think differently about time and our relation to time. And so they're working on a prototype of a clock that I think the latest notion is they're going to stick it in a mountain someplace. I don't know who's going to be in charge of tending to it and oiling it or whatever needs to be done. But some kind of a perpetual clock designed to keep the time for 10,000 years and remind us all that our stake in the future is long-term, to make our decisions in that longer, wider frame. But that comes up against the other thing that you mentioned, which is the hurried quality of our lives. And it seems as though time has been speeding up for a while. Computer people, especially those techno-utopians who are promising a brave new world right around the corner, they talk about the exponential curve of technological growth, and things are happening so quickly. And all of that inclines us not to take the long, to say, what's going to happen tomorrow to change my life, to change our world? And so this is one of the things I really want to look at in our course, is the collision of these perspectives. Is there a way to reconcile the long-term view, which I think is essential to our sustainability as a planet and as a species, to reconcile that with the pace of technological change and the hurried quality of our lives? Is there a way to have them both? Or is Bill McKibben right in saying it's time to hunker down, it's time to live much simpler lives, and in some ways turn away from technological developments that we could pursue? He wrote a book a while back called Enough, Staying Human in a Technological Age. He said it's time to pull the plug on some of these things. We shouldn't do everything we can do technologically just because we can. We need to ask ourselves which of these technologies is going to enhance the quality of our lives as human beings.
And which rob us of our humanity
and
altogether.
Rob us of our humanity, which not everybody's bothered by. They're happy to consider a post-human world. I'm still myself, I think, on the side of humanity.
But when it comes to sociological change, 10 years in the future, 20 years in the future, doesn't our political system work totally against that sort of long-range planning? The House is elected every 2 years in staggered terms. The president is elected every 4 years. The Senate is elected every 6 years. There are some states that have term limits. You can't run for any more than X number of terms for a particular office. And if all you're concerned about, if you're in a position of power, is making it to the next election, then how are you going to have a vision that will enable you to plan 10, 20 years in the future, let alone amass the kind of power base that will enable you to put those kinds of progressive changes into place?
I think that's a fair question. I think our political system, and maybe every political system, this stage of human evolution, is incapable of taking a 10,000-year, probably incapable of taking, a 10-year view of things. The old Soviet Union had 5-year plans. I'm not sure we can even do that, but we need to find a way to reward those who sincerely wish to pursue long-term objectives in the common interest of human beings. I suppose, to me, it's this question of responsibility again, and the responsibility falls on the shoulders of the electorate in a democracy. We need to have a longer attention span, pay attention to the left and right turns that our leaders make. Don't elect the ones who are inconsistent. Our parties need to do a better job of identifying what they stand for and continually putting up candidates who will support the long-term objectives that they have declared to be in our interest. No simple answer to this question, but if we want long-term results, we have to pay attention.
In the 60s and 70s, a man named Paul Ehrlich was identified as the father of the zero population growth movement, which has long since petered out to the point where I'm sure today's millennials don't know anything about it or hadn't read anything about it. But the idea was that the Earth is becoming overpopulated, and we've got to cut back on the number of babies that we bring into the world. China, the most populous nation on Earth, has a one-child policy, which is enforced governmentally. Talk a little bit about the intersection of population and ethics. We all know that there are some people who have so many children and so few resources with which to raise them properly, and I'm not talking about luxuries, just to be able to feed and clothe them. Yeah. And yet we recoil at the mention of any kind of forced sterilization as a society, most of us, because we know how that has been, not only is it personally invasive, we know it has been enforced in the past on a racial basis when it was implemented.
Yeah, the only way, and if we're committed to freedom, the only way to cap population is by appealing to the rationality of the citizenry and encouraging them to make that choice for themselves. I think there's no way free society can impose mandatory limits on reproduction. But it is possible to make that decision on environmentally sensitive grounds. McKibben, again, himself was an example of that and wrote about it in Only One, where he talked about deciding with his wife that their family be a three-person family, no more. There are lots of good reasons for considering that choice these days. And again, many people will say, well, that's not fair. We're going to take that upon ourselves as individuals and as families to make a decision that likely ignored by some of our neighbors and by other nations. No, it's not fair, but we're committed at this point to a free society. So fair or not, we're stuck that.
I suppose that it's a bit hypocritical for me to talk about politicians who refuse to look at the future and have a vision when we're all guilty of this to some degree or another within terms of our own bodies, because we all know we're going to age. We all know that the body deteriorates as we age, and we don't think about that in the heat of the moment. We have unprotected sex. We eat too much. We drink too much. We smoke. We do this. We do that. For the sake of argument, we can just take the steroid scandal in baseball as a perfect example. It never ceases to blow my mind that someone can inject something into his body which, for the moment, will give him superhuman athletic qualities, but in the long run will cause his health and his sex life, she said, being as euphemistic as possible for radio, to shrink.
Yes, it's ironic, and it's a perfect example of short-term thinking, and one more example of ways in which we've constructed a society that rewards short-term thinking. No, you're right. The athletes who made that choice, we can in some ways sympathize with the pressure they must feel. They're in a competitive environment in which they have the perception that if they don't take these substances, their competitive edge. I hope that's behind us now. The baseball world has declared that the steroids era ended a couple of years ago. I'm having a problem with that myself. I'm a big baseball fan. Grew up in St. Louis, so...
So Mark McGuire broke your heart.
He broke especially my daughter's heart, who's even a bigger fan of his than I ever was. And it bothers me that they brought him back as their hitting coach this year with no real contrition on his part. He said, yes, I need substances, but no, they didn't boost my performance. I would have hit 70 home runs anyway. No one believes that. I doubt that does.
Is it ethical to try to predict the future or to say that you can predict the future? A lot of people like to try. Some of them are as trivial as the people who write horoscopes, and some of them are as serious as academics who work for think tanks and attempt to do this in a way that they genuinely will believe will help some aspect of society.
Sure. I think it's, on a couple of levels, I think it's important to try to anticipate the curve of events, because if we don't, we will be caught up short with so many things happening in the climate and in the society. I think it's important it's important to dream and to dream about the desired future that we like to see for our children, grandchildren, and on beyond, because dreams are good motivators. And that's why one of the books that we'll read in this course is called What Will Change Everything. It's a collection of essays by people who tried their hand at predicting or at least painting some pictures of possibilities. possible futures, ways in which the world might be very different in the future, for better or worse. I think it's important for us to have those visions before us so that we can make more enlightened choices about what kind of world we want to work for here and now. So, yeah, I think it's ethically acceptable may even be the only responsible thing to do in the end, is to try to look forward and to say, where do we want to go?
Well, I would like to say that we have more time to talk about the future of life, but we've run out of time, so we'll have to save whatever else we have in our discussion for at some point in the future.
Well, let's hope we have one.
The Future of Life will be taught by Dr. Phil Oliver on Mondays and Wednesdays from 2:20 to 3:45 in room 202 of the James Union Building in the fall 2010 semester. It's Philosophy 4800. Thanks for being with us, Phil.
Thank you so much.
This is MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue. Join us again at the same time next Sunday. Don't forget, you can check out the podcast at your leisure at mtsunews.com, and we're available on iTunes.